Welcome to another edition of Should Have Listened to My Mother. I'm your host, Jackie Tantillo, and joining me today is Nancy Dubard Nunn, originally from, Nancy, where do we begin? Texas, Louisiana, North Carolina, South Carolina? Is that all the places you've lived?
No.
Okay, what am I missing?
Professional southerner.
Hi, Nancy. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. So tell me, what did I leave out?
Well, I was born in South Carolina.
Right.
I got married and moved to North Carolina. Then we moved to Tennessee. Then we moved to Louisiana. Then we moved to Georgia. Then we moved back to Louisiana. And after my husband died, I lived in my working job in construction. I lived in Florida. I lived in Texas. And I lived in Mississippi. And then I finally spent almost 2 years in New Jersey. That's where I met you. And that's I now live in Texas.
Is that the furthest north you've lived, New Jersey?
Yes. No, well, when Judy was in New York City, I was 25 miles farther north, but that was, I stayed with her a lot of times when she had all those babies in the house.
That's exactly right. Now, Nancy is a mom of Judy Nunn, who's a good friend, and she is a nationally and internationally recognized on-camera commercial actress, actor, and singer, and voice talent. So that's how we met, and we've gone away on vacation to their beautiful summer home that they had on the beach in South Carolina, and we'll get into all that throughout the show today. Where do we begin? You are one woman that I know for sure has a huge heart, Nancy. You have a huge heart. You're extremely generous. You are helping.
Appreciate that.
You're helping others all the time. And you actually remember you and I got to go to work at the community food bank. We got to go help this massive food bank. It's like this bigger than a football field, and they distribute food throughout New Jersey. But I also know that there's a lot of tough things that you've gone through in your life. And I'd like to talk to you about that, your perspective on life. But what part of that did your mom play?
Well, after you asked me, I thought about what I should say. And the first thing that came up that I should have listened to my mom, that I never did, seems so, what shall I say? Silly, but women, it's not silly. I was not a very good girl. I was more of a tomboy. And so most of the things my mother tried to teach me about being clean and washing my face and doing all the things that girls normally do just because they're girls didn't help me. And when my mother died at 101 and a half, she had fewer wrinkles on her face than I have on my face now. And I'm 30 years younger than she is. And so I've definitely failed to do that. But my mother, I don't know that I would say that she was a strict disciplinarian, but there was one thing that she just would not give up on, and that was you had to tell the truth. And lots of times, if you told the truth, if you'd done something wrong and you told the truth, she wouldn't punish you. But if you told the truth and it was something really bad wrong, she would punish you. So you never knew when you told the truth what was going to be a good outcome or a bad outcome. But that stuck with me all my life. Tell the truth.
What kind of punishment are we talking about here?
I'm talking about getting your little fanny flipped with a brush or a switch or whatever. Mm-hmm. In those days, people switched their children or beat their children, and I was one of those.
Was your mom the disciplinarian or your dad?
Both of them.
Who were you more afraid of?
Well, my father. I really was more afraid of my father. He used to switch us with switches, and I know you've probably never been switched, but they pull the leaves off, and everywhere a leaf comes off, it's kind of like a little joint or something. And I've had the blood cut out of my legs with switches and run down my legs when I was a child because I was really kind of a, like I said, tomboy. It was always beating up on my brother or doing something that most girls didn't do.
You were beating up on your brother. I bet you won, too, knowing you.
Well, I was 14 months older than he was. And so we just fought like cats and dogs, really. You know, I envy people who grew up in families and everybody loved everybody. Well, we didn't. Fred and I didn't do that.
Now, let's go back to your mom, 101 and a half, with no wrinkles.
Yes.
What was her regimen every day, or how did she take care
she
of herself?
She washed her face every morning and put some sort of cream on it, and she washed it every night and did the same thing. And at one time in her life, she had, after my father died, she had met a lady in the neighborhood who told her that Crisco was really good. So she gave mother this crystal jar with a pretty top on it, but it looked like it was silver. And mama put Crisco, not oil now, but the Crisco that looks like lard, in that. And she would wash her face with Ivory soap and then put that on it and go to bed or get up and go to work, whatever.
I got some. I have some upstairs. Should I go get some and put some on? Oh my gosh, I can't even imagine. I know I've heard women doing that before. I bet it's probably amazing. We're so silly.
Well, I had a chemistry professor in college who had worked for Great Day. I can't remember, but whatever the federal government organization is that makes sure that cosmetics are pure, and it has a title, I don't know what it is, but he had worked for them, and he said, as he was teaching the chemistry class one day, that all things that you have to put, like lipstick and creams and anything you put on your face, has to be edible.
I bet that's right, because it's toxic chemicals.
Right. And so if you can't eat it, it won't be on your cosmetic box. So mother just put, she made biscuits with Crisco and put it on her face.
I know that rule is long gone because you can't eat any cosmetics that are out there. That's for sure. Tell us your mom's name, please.
My mother was born Hetty Cameron Sanborn, Sanborn. And she married Fred Perry Dubard, DUBARD. So, and when he met her, when she was 18 years old, he was 25 or 26. He met her, and she told him her name was Hetty, and he said, "I don't like Hetty. I'm gonna call you Polly." And he never called her anything but Polly. And everywhere we lived, where she hadn't grown up, people knew her as Polly. They didn't even know her name was Hetty.
And she didn't protest?
She didn't. Isn't that pathetic? It is really pathetic. That would have been the last hour he ever saw me.
Hour? The last minute? And they were married for how long, your parents?
24 years and a few days. He gave my mother the ring I wear now because she'd only had a band. He gave her this, would be an engagement ring, on the 24th anniversary, and he died before.
Right. And your husband died of cancer.
Right.
At a very young age. Grueling experience.
57. My daddy died at 59.
How did that affect her?
Well, that's what I was going to say. What happened to her affected me. Her mother, her daddy died at 42, he was a banker, and he dropped dead in the bank 2 weeks after he'd taken out a $5,000 life insurance policy, which in those days was an enormous amount of money. But he left a wife and five children with $5,000 because there was no Social Security. This was like, Mama was eight, it was in 1912. And so she had two sisters who were married to ministers. And so she came, they were living in Arkansas, and after she saw that she couldn't make a living there, she came back to where her sisters were. And so she was actually washing people's clothes to feed those children when the money ran out. And my mother was going to school with a young woman named Esther Lynn Force. And they got to be really good pals, and like people did in those days, they told Mama, why don't you leave Hetty with us, and you go, because her sister's husband had moved to another town in South Carolina, and you take the four children, and we'll keep Hetty, and you can come back and get her. She never came back. She didn't come back to get her at all. And she left. She had another daughter, my Aunt Viola, and she left her with those people in that South Carolina town, and she took the three boys and went to New Jersey, to Paterson, New Jersey.
So did Hetty ever catch up with her siblings?
Oh, yeah. They caught up with her when she couldn't take care of herself anymore, and the boys, one of the boys had died, and the next oldest boy had four or five children in himself, and he didn't have any room for her. And Donald, the youngest one, he wasn't married, so she started staying, and she started visiting us. She would come for 4 months and stay with us 4 months, and then she'd go to Aunt Viola's for 4 months, and then she'd go back to Donald's for 4 months. And then he got sick or something, and so then she would come and stay with us for 6 months, and then she'd go and stay with Aunt Viola. And she actually died in the room next to mine in my brother's bed, because my brother, when she came for 6 months, my brother slept on the couch for 6 months.
Family taking care of family. That's
right.
pretty impressive.
Well, and that's just the way people did it in those days. You know, that nobody thought that we were extra anything. That was her mother. You take care of your mother.
That's exactly right, because she took care of us, hopefully,
right,
for the most part, right?
Right.
Okay, so your mom has this experience growing up. How close was she with the family that took her in, her friend who...
She was fairly close to them, and this is another story that goes with the era that she was living in. The Lindfors, Mr. Lindfors was from Finland, and Ms. Lindfors was from Germany. They were first-generation Americans, and so they had this enormous house. I remember it as a child. It always seemed like a castle. But they had, living with them beside their children, two or three aunts that never married. And those aunts taught my mother how to cook. And so my mother became the cook for the Lindfors. When she met my daddy, when she was 18, she was already their cook. She bought all the food and cooked it. And she did that up until she was in her 20s somewhere. And one day she was at the butcher's picking up some meat. And she was really pretty. She had blonde hair, golden blonde hair, and she kept it wrapped around her head or done something pretty with it. And somebody in the grocery store said to somebody else, who is that woman over there? And the woman that got the question answered this way, oh, that's the Lindfors white. And with that, my mother decided she cooked a lot more than she planned to. So she started going to secretarial training school, and she got a job at the VA. And when she left to get married to my daddy, she was working for the Veterans Administration and still living with them, but not cooking for them.
I was going to ask, was she the hired help? They brought
her
in.
That's what the people in that neighborhood thought.
Right.
Because she wasn't, quote, born there.
So they took advantage of her.
Right. And I can see in the way that she treated everybody else in the rest of her life was she never forgot that she didn't have a mother and a father, that she was always helping somebody. And one of the things I wrote down that I was going to tell you after Sis went to college and Daddy was dead and Fred and I were gone and married, my mother one day got up and talked to herself, what have I got to do today? And then she decided she was going to do something for somebody else every day the rest of her life. And she did, almost until she was in her 90s. She would bake them some biscuits, or she'd give them a phone call, or she'd go take them to the grocery store. She did something for somebody else every day.
So amazing.
It is amazing.
And this is one instance of one white woman that we know, let alone the generations of African Americans who have been treated way worse, enslaved. And this is the impact that she had and how she was able to turn her life around. I mean, she's been through so much.
She, like I said, she learned, they taught her how to cook. She was a great cook. It didn't make any difference who came to the house. If we were sitting down eating, another plate went on the table. You ate with us. And when we were growing up, the teenagers we hung out with called our house the zoo because none of them had families like ours, where anytime anybody showed up, you could eat.
Oh, that's the best. You always had food for anyone who joined you at the table. What was that like at dinner time? Did you all always eat together?
Yes. Well, we did until Fred and I started sports in high school, and then it was kind of catch can at supper because we'd be playing games. But
On Sundays?
We ate breakfast and lunch in the summertime together. And my daddy said a prayer, and everybody held hands, and we talked about all kinds of things. He was in the wholesale and produce business, and when we were learning math, we used to have to figure out how much you could sell a box of oranges for if it cost this, and you wanted to make 25 cents on the box. Whatever. We did math around the table. We did politics around the table. Lots of times on Sunday, we didn't leave the table for hours. We just sat there and talked. And there was always somebody there beside us.
That's what we're missing today. And not only in America, all over the world, that's what we're missing today. It's really important.
I want to go back to what you said about mother and me. Mm-hmm. Because since I was a tomboy, I really didn't fit her idea of being a girl, but she put up with it. But during the when I was in college, that was when the 1954 decision came down about Brown, about integrating the schools, and I was in favor of integrating the schools, and my parents weren't. And I would come home from college and be there on Sunday, and we would have this knockdown. I mean, knockdown. It wasn't a calm conversation. It was a knockdown argument over who was right about integration. And I wouldn't give up, and Daddy wouldn't give up. And so one day, my mother was driving me to work somewhere because I didn't have a car. And she said to me, you know, your father and I think you're a communist. Well, that was like a terrible thing to tell a child in those days, even though I was maybe 20 years old, because being a communist to a Southerner was like being the devil himself. And I will never forget her saying that. And for a long time, I really wasn't too happy with my mother. But by the time I got married and had children and got to be 30, my brain changed, and I found out she was really a wonderful person.
Well, that's often the case, and this must have just not only stabbed you in the heart, but that must have been shocking to you for her to use that term. You didn't see color. You didn't see, there were no lines, and after her childhood experience.
My mother and father, as far as I could tell, I'm sure they probably said the N-word, because everybody in the South did, but neither one of them, what I would call racist people. We had names that we treated like they were family. My daddy, I seen on Saturday afternoon, some of the people that worked for him would come and they stand on the front porch and he'd go out and talk to them and he'd give them money because they couldn't even make it through the week after they'd just gotten paid. And he, as far as I know, they never paid it back, but he'd do that. Because they'd come and tell him that Uncle Joe had died and they had to go to the funeral or something, which he knew wasn't the truth, but they were too embarrassed to say, I don't have any money to eat. And they worked for him. Because people didn't make money, much money in those days, really.
No, they clearly did not. And they did the best that they could with what they had, right?
But I was going to say that Mother went on to, like I said, doing something good for everybody. And she turned out, after Daddy died, she was my mentor because the church that she was going to put her on the board, administrative board, and then put her on the parish relations committee. And she was like one of the first women that had ever had that job in the Methodist Church, in the church that she was in. And from then on, I was like on fire to be first woman to do whatever I was going to do. I was tired of being told, you can't do that because you're a girl.
You were up against that a lot. You can't do that, Nancy, because you're a girl, right?
Right, right. Being a tomboy is bad enough because that messed up everybody's idea of what I was. I wore the first blue jeans anybody that I ever knew. I had the first pair of blue jeans. And that was just an unheard of thing. I would go on the farm and I want to go out and watch them castrate the pigs and castrate the cows. And no girl ever was even allowed out there. And I would be on the fence watching, and they were like horrified. But I told them I was going to be a doctor, and so they gave in. When I really thought I was going to be a doctor, but I turned out that I wasn't.
How old were you when you were doing all this kind of stuff? It's great.
Probably 15, 14, 15. You know, I was well into puberty, and so that was even maybe even worse, you know.
What made you go to an all-girls school?
Because when I started planning to go to college, which nobody in the right mind would do, we didn't even talk about going to college. When we talked about I was going to college, we didn't do anything about it until May. I graduated in May. So then I started looking. Well, I wanted to go to Clemson. But Clemson was all boy, and so you couldn't go there. And I couldn't go, and so I couldn't be a veterinarian because I was where the veterinarian school was. So then I wanted to go to be a doctor, and you couldn't go there because it was all men, College of Charleston. You had to go to another school, and then maybe they'd let you in there. And everything I wanted to do, there was no place for a woman. I wanted to be an engineer. No, they wouldn't let me do that because all the schools were for boys. And the University of North Carolina at that time would take women, but you had to, since I wasn't born in the state of, well, I was born in the state of North Carolina, but I wasn't living in the state of North Carolina, I had to go only when I got to be a junior. And so my father, in his wisdom, said, you can always get a job as a teacher or a secretary, so why don't you go to the school that does that? And that turned out to be Winthrop, and that was all girls. But it was a really good experience because up until then, even though I'd been president of the student body at Eau Claire High School and had been president of the whole city of Columbia's high school presidents, the girls just didn't do anything except play basketball. They didn't do anything and cheer. They had no other jobs. And when I went to Winthrop, you had to do everything. You had to be every single thing. If you got an idea, there wasn't any boy coming around to help you. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me, aha, I was right all along. I can do anything. I think that turned my life around to where I thought I could do anything, whether I could or I couldn't.
That is brilliant how that worked out. That is absolutely brilliant. No one around, no guy around to help you. So you had to learn how to figure. Well, I'm sure you figured everything out on your own. But
We had when you were a junior at Winthrop, you had to put on a show, and we You had to make the all of the props and the whatever you needed to change scenes and all that stuff. And I literally went around that town asking lumber yards if I could borrow lumber for them because he had no money. Now think about that. I said, I'll bring you back the lumber. Now you got to have a lot of guts, a lumberman to loan you some lumber and bring it back with all nail holes in it.
I love it. I love it, love it, love it. So did, anyway, was this a 4-year school or 2-year school?
Four. I got a degree in a BA in history and English. And I'm a horrible English student. But that was the only other thing. I had taken so many history classes. I took all the history classes I could take. But it worked out because the Methodist Church, his great wisdom, picked me and a boy from Clemson to come to New York City and then go to Washington, D.C. to see how the United Nations and our government worked. And that was my first airplane ride. I came to New York City. And when I got back, because it was only like 4 days or something like that, when I got back, I had in my inbox this thing from the University of Denver, which unbeknownst to me was originally a Methodist college, offered me a scholarship. And I signed up for it and I got it. In international relations, I didn't get first place. I got second place. But anyway, it was like this enormous sum, $750 a year. And so that's, I went, Daddy and Mom said they would put the, all the bills that, you know, that I couldn't do. I always had to work in the summertime and earn money to spend for myself. They paid the tuition. And so I flew away again.
That must have changed your life, an experience like that, right? That whole scholarship thing.
It did. Well, because I really thought when I got out there, international relations, it turned out in those days, history teachers didn't have to cover from cover to cover on a book of history. They just started, and wherever the year ended, that's where they ended. So if they didn't get to the end of where you were living, you know, that era of time, they didn't teach it in school. I came home, my daddy died on November the 17th, and they flew me back home. And when the funeral was over, Fred was going to college at Walford, which is a Methodist college. And some of the men that he was knew came back by the house. And my husband, the dean, came back, Bill, the rest is history. We got married and lived together 29 years and 11 months to today.
Did you ever think that you would have to stay or your brother would ever have to stay and live with your mom after your dad died?
No, because I was at graduate school. Fred was only a year behind me, so he must have been a senior in college.
Right, so you had to finish.
So we both just stayed in. And by the time I found out I was in love with Bill, I was coming out of graduate school. And so I didn't finish graduate school. I took all the coursework and then left. I had an advisor that helps you write your thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And he had gone to Columbia University and gotten his master's and PhD. And so he wanted me to write my thesis like Columbia University. And I actually did maybe 6 weeks worth of research, and he said, this is all wrong, I won't accept it, start over.
What was your thesis on?
My thesis was Southeast Asia's, they were trying to put together at that time something like NATO, but it was going to be called CETO, and so I was working on that with all mostly with India and Indonesia and getting information. And he said, I can't read your handwriting. You have to do this over. And I was like, no,
that was the issue.
I'm out of here, man. I'm out of here.
Wait, the handwriting was an issue, not the content?
I said he couldn't read my handwriting.
He couldn't read your handwriting.
No.
Not even the content. It was just the handwriting that was the problem.
Right. So So he wanted me to do it all over.
Love takes care of a lot of things, doesn't it?
It certainly does. What I found out later, because most of the people that I went to school with 16 people. 9 of them were foreign students, and there were only 6 Americans. And they, since I talk so funny, so Southern, they call me a foreign student because I didn't speak English. But I found out later that the only job that they were training us for was to go to the State Department and work. And one of the women that was in that class actually did eventually work in the State Department. But the State Department then was the absolutely tight men. There were no women that were ever going to be ambassadors or anything then. And that would have been like killing me. And so, like I said, I finished my casework, coursework and came home and got married.
How much of you is your mom?
How much of me? Well, probably not enough. I really am far more abrupt. She just wasn't that kind of person. She wasn't mealy mouth or a mouse or anything. She just was more polite than I am. And like I said, it's really kind of hard to talk to people that haven't been tomboys because we see things differently than girls do. I'm sorry, it doesn't translate into English. It sounds like, okay, I could actually be. In fact, I did say this one day. I said, you know what? I think maybe I must be a lesbian. I said this to my husband. I thought he was going to kill me. He's like, what? What are you talking about? Because I feel more in the middle than either a girl or a man. I feel, and I always have, like, okay, I could just be in the middle. I bet you didn't think this was going to come out in this conversation.
No, I totally, because I know what a tough time you always had. You were always in the middle from what the stories that we've heard. But obviously your husband fell madly in love with you.
Oh, yeah. And we were crazy in love, really and truly. People said that. He was a good man for me because even though I was, like I said, crazy, different. He loved that, and he helped me. When the children were smaller and we moved to Atlanta, I got the church asked me if I would help them with their youth program, and so I would have to go to an administrative board meeting once a month, and he would bring the children and sit out in the hall and watch them while I went to administrative board meeting. Now, there are not too many guys that would do that. They would have said, too bad, sister. You just can't, you can't take that job.
He totally supported you.
Yes, he did.
Just wonderful, especially in that era.
Being in the middle let me do things. For instance, if I just like I said, what I learned in Winter, if a guy could do it, I could do it. You can't say, well, you can't do that because you're a girl. Well, only one thing that you can't do, and that's sexual, if you're a girl. But the point of the matter is, if you can lift that boulder, I can lift that boulder. I may not do it the way you do it, but I can lift it.
All right, Nancy. You should be out there teaching classes. My gosh, you should be out there teaching women and touching their lives and inspiring them, because a lot of women don't believe in themselves the way you do.
Well, that's because their family, my family let me be crazy, even though they knew that I didn't fit in. I'll tell you how desperate they were. When I was 16 years old, I'd never had a date. And we, my mother and father, were going to St. Louis for a business meeting. And so they took me to Aunt Viola's house in North Carolina. And before I got there, they got on the phone and picked out somebody in that town would date me because I'd never had a date.
Did you wear your jeans? Or did you have to wear a dress?
I'm trying to think. But the guy had a motorcycle. It was a great date. I don't think they knew that.
Oh, my gosh. They must have been so blown away. He showed up on a motorcycle?
Yes, we went. In fact, we almost got killed on that motorcycle. It's a real hilly part of North Carolina. And this man was coming down the hill in a car, and he, you know how sometimes you go too fast and you swing instead of staying on your side of the curve,
yeah,
you go across the line.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he came across the line. He was coming toward us, and you could see he was fighting that wheel, trying to get it back. And before he ran head on into us, he got the car back on his side of the road.
Wow, so I guess it was a good date. That's memorable for sure.
But anyway, I'm sure they were desperate that I wasn't going to be a really close girl, because people didn't talk about it. Well, they did talk about it, but they didn't talk about it in front of children, about people being lesbians and everything. I played softball. I was a catcher for a softball team for the Southern Bell Telephone Company my last year in high school. And the first game I played in, my mother and my aunt, they came to see me play. Well, I didn't end up catching. I ended up, they put me on third base because third baseman hit a Hunter Plum or something. And when we got in the car, they said, you can't go back. You can't play there anymore. Well, that was because I was the only straight person on the team. Everybody else was a lesbian. I didn't even know it. I didn't know
didn't make a difference. Right. Didn't make a difference, right?
Yeah, because everybody in that era was frantic that you weren't going to be normal, men and women. That's how come in places in the world today they still kill people that aren't, quote, normal. But I want to say one more thing, because I feel like I'm using up all your time here. What happened that I ever got in construction, I was doing work for the League of Women Voters. And you always have a coach. They don't call them coaches, but from another League of Women Voters that comes and sits in on your meetings so that the group doesn't go off on a tangent. And this particular woman was sitting in on our meeting, and she said, "Do you know anybody who wants to go to work? We need a secretary at my husband's company." So I decided that I would try for that job that lady brought up, who she later turned out to be really one of my best friends. But they hired me, and I went to work for a construction company, a general construction company. And 2 weeks later, I came home from work, and I told Bill, I said, "I don't know why, but this is where I should have been all my life, in construction." And I worked in construction 21 years. I loved every day. I would have paid them to let me work. Honest and truth.
And you were up against a lot of tough guys, too, that could live. They didn't
yeah,
take
and
you
I was
seriously.
The only woman. They had, in I was working in Metairie, but that's a suburb of New Orleans. They had during the Second World War, one woman project manager because they ran out of men. Because the war went on so long. And about a year and a half after the war was over, she retired and went back home. And so from 1948 till I went to work in 1973, I didn't go to work as a project manager, but in about two years I was a project manager. There had been no women project managers in New Orleans. And I was the first one for about 3 years. Now there's about 35 or 40 of them.
Congratulations. That's pretty great. Your mom, Hetty, lived to over 100 years old. Did she have any interesting habits? Didn't she used to have a drink every day or what?
Yeah.
So tell me about what Hetty's social habits were, perhaps.
We always had beer at the house. And we always had a party at Christmas for everybody. And we always had eggnog with bourbon in it. But the most I ever saw my mother and father drink would be two drinks, and that was it. And they put everything away. And so that's the way I grew up, was thinking that was the way it was. And after Daddy died, we would just have cocktail hours. Most of the time, Mother didn't drink more than two. But she just got where she loved her cocktail hour. And after she went into assisted living, we actually had the doc write a prescription. So she had an ounce of sherry at lunch and an ounce and a half of scotch at supper with her meals. And she did and took away until maybe a year or two before she died.
She had to get a prescription?
Yes.
Sherry at lunchtime and scotch. Did she ever smoke?
Not that I know of.
Isn't that funny? Not that you know of. If you could have a conversation, a direct one-on-one conversation with your mom today, what would you say to her?
Oh, gosh. I would say, Mom, you can't imagine how many times I almost picked up the phone and called you to ask you how to cook something. It's all been more than 10 years now that she's dead, and I still think about calling her when I don't know the answer. Particularly if I know something about somebody that she knew that has died or something, or something about the family, because she kept up with all that stuff, and she could tell you things like that. And then I realized, hey, she's not there. We'd just be talking about what you missed.
Nancy Dubard Nunn. Never a dull moment. Thank you for joining us today, Nancy.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a fun. I really do appreciate you asking me.
Nancy Dubard Nunn, calling from Texas to share stories of her mom on Should Have Listened to My Mother. I'm Jackie Tantillo. Thank you for joining us.